Andy, our co-chairs of the New York chapter, for an outstanding group of programs this year. You guys just did an absolutely terrific job, and many, many thanks for that. Also, I'd like to thank you for helping to put this program together on short notice. Obviously, of some interest and some import to the copyright community, for sure. I assured Jenny it was all about her and not about Justice Breyer's opinion. So we're looking forward to the panel coming up here. Without further ado, let me introduce Joe Peterson, the co-chair of the New York chapter, to introduce today's panel and kick things off here. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Joe. We're delighted to have this panel today. As Joe mentioned, I'm Joe Peterson, along with Craig Mende. I co-chair the New York chapter. Craig and I are going back and forth debating what panel to run for this last session, and then Kirk Sang dropped, and it made a very easy decision. Obviously, a very interesting decision, but people kind of polarized and thoughts on both sides, so we're delighted to present the panel that we are going to present. I will introduce the moderator, which is Dan Hunter. Dan is a professor of law and the director of the Institute for Information Law and Policy at New York Law School. And Dan will in turn introduce the remainder of the panel. Before I pass it off to Dan, I just want to thank the planning committee members that have been so helpful to Craig and myself in planning this panel. They are Matthew Moore, Cynthia Rado, Matt Stratton, and Vijay Lala. So without further ado, I will pass the mic over to Dan.
Well, thank you very much to the Joes for the introduction. My name is Dan Hunter, as was indicated before. It's my pleasure and privilege to moderate this panel and introduce the speakers today. I'm going to introduce them in the order that they are. I'm going to talk. Moving across to my left, your right, we have Alan Adler first. Alan is a general counsel and vice president for government affairs for the Association of American Publishers, the trade association for the U.S. book publishing industry. Sorry, American publishers, then. He deals with regulatory litigation and legislative responses for the association. I'm not going to read out all of the biographies. He's also the only member of the panel here who has only one earring. I think that's fair to say. Okay. Next to him, we have Lisa T. Simpson. Lisa is a partner in the IP and litigation group at Orrick, Herrington & Sutcliffe. She is, of course, counsel to Supat Kurtzing on the successful appeal, 163, and so she's able to talk a little bit about the inside baseball of how that came about, and we'll look to her for that. And then finally, we have Jennifer Pariza. Jennifer is the Senior Vice President of Litigation and Piracy for the Recording Industry Association of America, and she oversees litigation matters related to both digital and hard copy issues, as well as deals with other issues as counsel for the RIAA. So very briefly, before I throw to Alan to kick us off with the sort of the initial presentations for each of the panelists, just let me give a little bit of context. Of course, I imagine that you've all read Kurtzing, or at least familiar with it. I'm not going to go through it in a great deal of detail, except to sort of set up a little bit in relation to how the issues might be framed, right? So, of course, Supat Kurtzing brings some books over legally made in Thailand, sells them in America as a consequence of the trade differential, the fact that it's that prices here are higher for the same product than they are in Thailand. And the question that is presented to the court is, were these books lawfully made under this title? The reason, of course, for that is that we're looking at the interaction between three different sections, Section 106.3, 109A, and 602A. 106.3, the distribution right, says that only the copyright owners have the exclusive right to distribute. That's more or less fine. We sort of assume that that's okay. We know that that's affected by 109A, the general first sale doctrine. That is clear in relation to books and other works which have been produced in or made in the United States. But the question is presented is, well, what about books which are brought in from overseas? 602A reads, and it's in your materials. You can have a look. I think it's on about the third or fourth page. Matthew has kindly produced his materials for us. But 602A is a pretty standard parallel importation provision, standard in the sense of many copyright acts around the world have similar sorts of parallel importation provisions. 602A says importation into the United States without the authority of the owner of copyright under this title of copies of a work that have been acquired outside the US is an infringement of the exclusive right to distribute copies under Section 106. So we think, well, that's absolutely fine. But the challenging thing, the tricky bit, the bit that the entire case rested on is the language in 109A, which is lawfully made under this title. So the question is, well, does 109A amount to something which is geographically limited because these things are lawfully made under this title, or is it not geographically limited? And our panelists today obviously have different perspectives on that. The court in 6.3, in the 6.3 ruling, said that there was no geographic limitation, right? And that as a result, books made overseas were caught by or covered by Section 109A. The first sale doctrine was not geographically limited, and we were away to the races as far as the parallel importers of this sort of material is concerned. I don't need to tell you it's a long and tricky decision. It rests on three or four different bases, which I hope the panelists will start to pull out a little bit. But I'll leave it to them to talk about the linguistic, historical, the statutory construction principles and so on. And I know that Alan has a particular view on this case, and my guess, I could be wrong here, Alan, don't let me put words in your mouth, but I don't think you're entirely happy with it. All right, Alan, over to you.
Thank you. I feel silly to say in front of an audience of lawyers that I have to make the usual lawyer's disclaimer about what I'm going to say, but with so many dozens of publishing lawyers reviewing this decision, obviously what you're going to hear today is my own view of the case, at least for the moment. Yes, this was a very unsatisfying decision for very many reasons. One, though, was the fact that it appeared that the majority, and particularly Justice Breyer, committed the same, fault that the political wings of copyright debates usually do. And that is, he tended to look at most of what he was considering in the abstract and didn't consider the role that the particular provisions he was interpreting address in a much larger context. The fact of the matter is that the United States Congress and successive administrations for the last three or four decades at least, going back to the time of the 1976 Copyright Act, regardless of who was in power, have all promoted export trade as a major underpinning of a healthy U.S. economy. And export trade, of course, is the context in which these issues about the Copyright Act and the relationship between the first sale doctrine and the ban on unauthorized importation should have been viewed. Usually, the Supreme Court has shown a credible deference to Congress when it comes to the policies that are embodied in the Copyright Act, at least where there aren't constitutional questions to be answered. And here there was no constitutional question. In fact, as everyone likes to say, this case involved the Supreme Court basically having to interpret the meaning of five words and how those five words made these two provisions, first sale and unauthorized importation, relate to each other. So at the outset, let me just flag three things that I think were really problematic. Justice Breyer engaged in what he called a linguistic analysis to try to address some of the difficulties in parsing what lawfully made under this title meant in the context of the relationship between those two provisions. And the most important thing that he felt he needed to accomplish, and that indeed the court needed to accomplish in engaging in this linguistic analysis, was ultimately to make sure that the court did not render any part of this statute pointless or superfluous, because the first rule of statutory construction is Congress doesn't put superfluous or pointless language into a statute when it enacts it. Every word in the statute has some meaning and some relation to the other words in the statute. So this is an important point, and Justice Breyer pursued it quite vigorously. Unfortunately, he didn't pursue it successfully, because although he was very concerned about potentially rendering pointless two different provisions of those sections of Section 602 that deal with unauthorized importation, he never focused on the exceptions to those provisions that Congress had put in it. And he rendered those exceptions, whether he viewed them as adequate or meaningless or not, he rendered them meaningless by creating essentially the first sale doctrine as the uber exception, if you will, to 602's ban on unauthorized importation. He did so primarily because he seemed to have been inordinately convinced that the parade of horribles that Mr. Kurtzsang's supporters and Mr. Kurtzsang had introduced into the court record was something that simply could not be looked askance. He needed to be able to address the fact that if this parade of horribles was viable and came to pass, it could not have been the intention of Congress to structure the statute in a way that would allow that. Unfortunately, he failed to grapple with the fact that when he said this parade of horribles was too serious, too extensive, and too likely to come about for us to dismiss them as insignificant, the reality is that what he was dealing with was a parade of worst-case scenarios, hypotheticals, that had never come to pass despite the fact that the law, or at least the posture of the law that he believed was creating the conditions to make that parade of horribles viable, had been in that particular posture for nearly 30 years. So, having looked at his linguistic analysis and his parade of horribles, then he gets into the history of the first sale doctrine and tries to come up with a reasonable reading of how the first sale doctrine impacts the ban on unauthorized importation based on its history. And interestingly, he traces it all the way back to Lord Cook. He emphasizes that Lord Cook believed the doctrine was important because it was a refusal to permit restraints on the alienation of chattels, and that was necessary to permit trade and traffic and bargaining and contracting with respect to all kinds of chattels. But unfortunately, he didn't seem to realize that Congress had also taken into account, back in 1976, the importance of the way the copyright law was structured in order to be able to facilitate trade and traffic and bargaining and contracting with respect to that kind of chattel that was unique to the Copyright Act because it was copyright-based. And so when he said that Constitution's language nowhere suggests that its limited exclusive right should include a right to divide markets or a concomitant right to charge different purchases at different prices for the same book, you have to ask, what happened to the principle of divisibility? In 1976, one of the major changes that Congress made from the 1909 Act was it took a concept of copyright that Congress had declared in 1909 to be indivisible, and suddenly recognized that in the modern world of global trade, it was important to understand that the exercise of the rights of copyright would depend upon its divisibility. And indeed, as a result of what Congress did in 1976, the reality is that the 1976 Act expressly contemplates multiple copyright ownership interests in individual works, and that any of those rights specified under Section 106 can be licensed or sublicensed and may be granted with limitations on time, geography, or the type of use permitted, and that each exclusive right could be subdivided infinitely, and each subdivision of an exclusive right could be owned and enforced separately. It couldn't possibly be the case that having set up such a regime of copyright in 1976 and watched for four decades as copyright owners exercised those rights territorially, that he couldn't have realized that Congress had anticipated the role that copyright would play, and particularly the role that the ban on unauthorized importation would play ultimately in facilitating vigorous promotion of the export of U.S. goods that are copyright-based. He didn't seem to think that the tradition of linking the first sale doctrine to the role of trade and bargaining over chattel had anything to do with the way he was now reading the first sale doctrine in connection with the importation provision and its role in export trade for the United States. That was a fundamental mistake. The one good thing that you could say about this decision, though, is that it seems pretty clear that a supermajority, if not a unanimous court ultimately believe this is a policy question for Congress to resolve, because it is so integrally intertwined with global trade and the desire of the U.S. government, regardless of which party or which part of the government is acting on policy, to promote a vigorous export trade for U.S. businesses and manufacturers. So hopefully the results of this decision can be corrected.
Well, we'll have a chance to talk about that in the questions. Please, sir, give us some context in relation to this decision.
Sure. I'd just start and say that where Alan concluded is probably where we agree. And other than that, maybe not so much. But we came into the Kurtzen case at the petition for cert stage and filed that initial brief with the Supreme Court. We were not involved at the district court level, though, or the Second Circuit level, although we did work closely with Kurtzen's counsel from those two courts. Although I understand there's a lot of controversy about this decision, what this really comes down to is looking at the statutory interpretation. And that was where we started when we first got the case. We started looking at statutory sections, and basically what we concluded was there was really only one way to go with this. When you start with 602 and you see, as the court held in Quality King, that 602 is specifically invoking the right of 106, and then you go to 106 and you look at it, and it's specifically invoking the exceptions, which include the exception of 109, you're really left in a place where it's clear that 109 is expected to trump 602. And this was a strict statutory construction, which we thought was not only true to what happened in Quality King, but also true to the statute as it was written. Then you get to the next question, which is what this case really ended up focusing on. What happens now? You look at 109, it's got this language in it, right? It's got the under this title, lawfully made under this title. Does that change the outcome? And when we looked at this in detail and really started digging into it, the answer was clearly no. And the reasons for that were several, but one was, let's look at what the other options were. At that point, the other options were really not very good. You had the Second Circuit that came out and said, okay, that language must mean that this needs to be manufactured on U.S. soil. That was one extreme approach to the statute, and probably closest to the statutory language of any other approach that had been taken to that point. You had the Ninth Circuit, which went a little haywire. Their approach was completely atextual. They said manufactured in the United States, or if you sell it once in the U.S., that'll be sufficient too. But there is no basis for that in the statute anywhere. So the Ninth Circuit option was really not a true option. The Third Circuit had suggested that it was uncomfortable with the language that requires the new manufacturing in the U.S., but it hadn't really articulated a definitive standard. Then you had Costco, who in its appeal up before the Supreme Court had taken the position that it meant made in the USA unless you had some kind of extra license out there. They took a hybrid position that was intended to account for the hypothetical and Quality King, but what they ended up with was a completely atextual reading of the statute, again, which the Supreme Court beat them up on at oral argument. So that was the other option. Then we had the government, who also had been flip-flopping on their position in Quality King. The government said, you know what, lawfully made under this title means exactly what Kurtzen eventually said that it means. It means, made in conformance with this title. They took that position in Kurtzen. It didn't work out for them. They switched their position, later on, both in Costco and in Kurtzen. But the options were not strong. There really weren't a lot of choices there. So what we really decided to do when looking at the statutory construction was to take a strict view of this. It really has to mean exactly what it says, and that's it. We can't graft on conditions like the Ninth Circuit. We can't graft on conditions like Costco. We have to stick with what's written. Now, that, of course, leads to some problems, right? We're faced, once we take that position, we're then stuck head-on with that Quality King dicta. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, although I suspect that it's got a lot of play at this point, that's the hypothetical where there's the British publisher and the American publisher, and the British publisher's works end up in the U.S., and the court suggested, well, isn't that supposed to be not covered by the first sale doctrine? That was the suggestion of the hypothetical. So we had to handle that head on. And then secondly, if we're taking the position that lawfully made means lawfully made and it can be anywhere, and that means that the first sale doctrine applies regardless of where these things are manufactured or sold, then we have to look at 602 and what exactly is 602 left to do, because it has to do some work, or as Alan pointed out, we're violating the fundamental tenet of statutory construction, which means that we have to look, we can't read that whole section out of the statute. So those were the two areas where we focused. Interestingly, on the Quality King dicta, and I should step back a little bit, because when we took this position, when we decided to say first sale means first sale anywhere, we got a lot of pushback from Miki, from other parties that have been involved in these cases. The suggestion was that it was just way too extreme. It just wasn't going to work. It was way too extreme. Again, we felt that was really the only way to go. And we proceeded from there to deal with the two problems. So the Quality King dicta was an interesting thing, because as a copyright lawyer, me and my colleagues from the copyright perspective were really focused on that. How do we get that to work out with what we've got here? How do we reconcile it? Is there a way around it? Our appellate lawyer, Josh Rosenkranz, who argued this case in front of the Supreme Court, and given his sort of experience in front of the court, felt very comfortable saying, you know what, I'm comfortable just saying that dicta is wrong. And we were like, whoa. okay, well, Josh, if you think you can get us past the dicta being wrong, then we'll focus on 602, because we can probably handle that. So, we made the decision to go forward on those fronts. We found, through the legislative history, that 602 is doing a lot of work. It actually is addressing the concerns that were raised during the drafting process, those concerns being lawless states that didn't have copyright laws, those concerns being the movie industry and the rental of movies that were then being essentially stolen and sold, and it addressed the rogue distributor where the copies hadn't been sold yet. And so 602 was still addressing many of those concerns that the bar and the those who were involved in the drafting process had raised. So it seemed to us that there was a substantial amount of work, or at least a significant amount of work, still being done by 602. Josh was going to handle the Quality King dicta for us, and we felt comfortable proceeding with this strict construction that folks were not particularly in favor of. But just to speak a little bit to the policy issues, what ends up happening with this is that there isn't any other construction that can deal with the unending control of the copyright owner. And everyone was struggling to find something that would work, that would say, okay, we don't have to have, first sale applying everywhere. We can have it applying, just in the US, and we can deal with the foreign made copies in this way. And everyone came up with different ways of trying to handle that. As I said, the Ninth Circuit said, okay, you sell it once in the US and it's done. And then, as you saw, Justice Ginsburg and the government in the Kurtzang case went back to Bob's Merrill. And they said, well, we're going to deal with that with Bob's Merrill, because we can say that Bob's Merrill meant one sale, one right, your right to vend counts once, and it would kick in, essentially, to pick up the slack to cover this internal downstream control. But there's a lot of problems with that argument. Now you've got a case. Bob's Merrill was the case that the legislature codified when they codified the first sale doctrine. So it's a little bit of a steep argument, and the Supreme Court wasn't buying it at all when we were there at oral argument, to say that there's something left of Bob's Merrill, some work that Bob's Merrill is still going to do, even though it's now been codified in Section 109. And for the government and Justice Ginsburg's arguments to work, for them to be able to fix the internal downstream control problem, they have to invoke Bob's Merrill. It just isn't a very strong strong platform to rest on. So,
Lisa, I don't mean to cut you off, but I actually didn't mean to cut you off. we're going to run short on time.
Yes,
is there anything else? Well,
yeah.
We'll cover the rest in questions. So, Jennifer, your perspective, or the RIA's perspective.
Well, as a content-owning industry, the music industry, obviously stands with the book publishers, the motion picture industry, software, games, you know, all of the content owning industries in viewing this decision very unhappily, and with some measure of surprise, I have to say. Oral argument gave us a strong clue as to where this was going, but before that, people felt fairly confident that the Supreme Court would continue to, in our view, give more life to 602 than we are left with now. 602, which is the importation restriction, now means you can't import something if you only have a rental right or if it was manufactured illegally. In our view, 602 was never intended to be read so limitedly. Is that all? Yeah, right. But with all the concerns that Alan raised, that Congress had in mind the notion that American manufacturers, be they hard good manufacturers or intellectual property creators, would have the right to segment their market globally. In a global economy, it's terribly important, we believe, and we believe Congress thinks, for American manufacturers to be able to segment the market in a way that makes sense to them. So that might mean, for example, selling your goods less expensively in Thailand or China, where people have less ability to pay for your goods and compete with a whole universe of pirated material, whereas you can sell it at a higher price in more developed nations. That is a principle that has been in existence as a trade policy of the United States for decades and decades. It lives on in 602 in the Copyright Act, and we're not exactly sure where we got to this place where Kurt Sang, let's for the moment call him Costco, can purchase a container's worth of cheap material in China or India or Thailand and bring it back to the United States and sell it for nothing. Now, that's good in the short run, maybe, for individual consumers who want to purchase goods cheaply here, and it's politically difficult for Congress to say, no, U.S. population, I know you like Costco, but I'm not going to let you buy, you know, discount watches. But for American manufacturers, this is a very, very devastating opinion that is going to cause them untold heartache and economic woe. So that is true. I was asked to be on this panel to speak particularly of the music industry's interest in this decision, because it's not necessarily obvious from the face of the decision. But you know, in that regard, we're just like every other manufacturing enterprise that is troubled by the notion that there can no longer really be effective market segmentation. More specifically to music, there are a couple of ways in which this touches the music industry. One was alluded to previously. It's not music necessarily, but all copyright industries, which is the idea that you can have a divided territory deal, which is fairly common in music. It's even more common in motion pictures, which is that the copyright owner gives a license to an entity in the United States and a different entity abroad. For example, Pink Floyd. The license to distribute Pink Floyd's music in the United States belongs to Sony, and it belongs to EMI in the UK. So let's say, hypothetically, this might be tomorrow's real problem, today it's my hypothetical, EMI manufactures a CD of Pink Floyd in the UK, for sale in the UK, and it says right on it, for sale in the UK only. Somebody, and EMI says, let's not say it's a Kurt Sang or an individual person. Let's say it's EMI. EMI says, you know what? I'm a little unhappy that I only have distribution rights in the UK. I would really like the US market. Pink Floyd's pretty popular in the United States. Thank you, Kurt Sang Court. I am now going to sell these copies in the United States. Yesterday, this was improper, because the U.S. copyright owner could use its exclusive rights to prevent that work from coming into the United States. Today, I'm not sure it can, because that work was lawfully made. Apparently, under this title means somehow anything other than piratical. And now EMI has a whole new market that it can exploit. P.S., Sony cannot sell its goods in the U.K. because the U.K. doesn't have a decision like Kurt's saying. So this is, you know, this I am quite certain was not intended, and yet this is a fairly obvious consequence. This is the dicta that was discussed, that Lisa was discussing, right? In the dicta comes from the older case of Costco. And there, the court said, look, it happens all the time. You have a situation where you've got different, you have different distribution rights in different territories. Surely, we don't mean for the foreigner to be able to bring goods into the United States and sell them here. That is the Josh Rosenkrantz solution. We didn't mean it. You know, when we said, surely that wasn't the scenario that would be permitted under U.S. copyright law, Josh convinces the court that they didn't actually mean what they said. Though they didn't explain what they mean or why they said it or why it was actually wrong. But somehow or other, he got them to bite down on that hook. And Justice Ginsburg calls him out on it and says, yes, it was dicta, but why was it wrong exactly? This is a classic scenario in which made under this title has to mean something more than not illegal. Made in conformity with doesn't mean anything you want it to mean just because it's not illegal. So that's scenario number one that is of concern to us. This split territory deal and the implications for seeing ex-US product floating US markets. P.S., there's a companion problem that goes along with that, which is the work that has gone PD abroad, but is not PD in the United States. So now it's not, you know, your frenemy EMI who maybe you can work things out with. Now there's a whole world of small music entrepreneurs who are selling cut rate product of works that have gone a public domain abroad. Presumably those works are not illegally manufactured. Are they made under this title? It's not so clear. Can they now be brought into the United States? I think there's a very big, there's an open question as to that. The other issue that is unique to the music industry has to do with music publishing money. So music, the money that record companies have to pay music publishers, the mechanical royalty rate, is different on a country-by-country basis. And you will perhaps not be surprised to learn it's much higher in the United States than it is elsewhere in the world. So how about this hypothetical, which might be tomorrow's problem? Let's say I create the Jenny Parisa Record Company. We'll call it JP Records. And JP Records has to pay 9 cents a copy to the publishers in the United States, but I have to pay far, far less abroad. So I have an idea. I'm going to set up a foreign subsidiary. We'll call it JP Records France, or more likely JP Records Thailand. And JP Records Thailand is going to manufacture my Rihanna CDs, if by some stroke of luck I somehow owned and controlled Rihanna's works. And I'm going to manufacture them there. I'm going to sell them back to JP Records US. What mechanical royalty rate will I pay? Well, obviously, I'm going to pay the Thailand rate. That's where the sale has occurred. So I pay the Thailand rate, and then JP Records US takes them back into the United States, and I sell them totally free and clear of US publishing. I honestly cannot think of any reason why that would not be perfectly permissible under the Kurtzsang decision. And I think the U.S. music publishing industry is probably wringing their hands over this very scenario right now. So so there's a lot of collateral damage that may or may not have been envisioned by this court, which we're all going to have to mop up now.
Okay, well, thanks, everybody. We'll have a few questions here amongst us, I think, and then throw to the room. I guess the question for Alan and Jennifer, sort of focusing upon the Copyright Act as a trade policy act, and Alan, you said that very specifically. I'm just sort of wondering, is that really what the Copyright Act is for? I know that's where we've gotten to, but should that actually be what copyright is for? I mean, the example that I'm thinking of is Jenny's example, right? JP Records, you said, well, you know, there's no reason why this can't be possible under Kurtzing, and I'm sort of thinking there's no reason why that isn't a bad thing, except for the music publishing industry of the US. Wouldn't it mean a good thing that we actually have greater competition, lower prices, essentially the Costco argument that's there? I mean, I know it's going to mean a restructuring of your industries, but should I, as a consumer, or as somebody representing the interest of society, care about that? Why should I care?
Yeah, I think you should care about it. First of all, when I say the Copyright Act, it's not that it's a trade act in and of itself, but copyright, like trademark, like patent, is a species of intellectual property right that deals with the question of ownership or control of a good that can, of course, be involved in global trade. And again, when you realize that export policy has been based upon the general idea that it is good for the United States both as an economic matter and as good for the United States as a matter of foreign relations to see U.S. products as much as possible out in the world, in global markets, in countries all throughout the globe. The question of what role does copyright play in promoting that kind of policy is what was at issue here. Ordinarily, it seems to me that this would have been the type of case where the Supreme Court, had the majority decision been written almost by any other justice, would have shown the kind of deference that the court has shown to Congress in the past with respect to the way it deals statutorily with copyright as a matter of law and policy. But through the jaundiced view that Justice Breyer has always had of copyright, that didn't come through. The reality is, for example, that when you talked about the parade of horribles in this case, this was a classic case where what the court ultimately should have said, that's not for us to deal with. You know, you should be petitioning Congress if you believe that the law as Congress wrote it could lead to this type of set of scenarios if it's interpreted the way the law has basically been interpreted over the last three decades, then your argument is with Congress. This isn't a case where the court should be able to change that because, again, it's not within the jurisdiction of the court to be writing copyright policy. But in this instance, what you had was the court engaging in a very tortured linguistic analysis of statutory construction that basically ignored the role that copyright, and particularly these provisions as they relate to each other, is supposed to play in larger policies of the United States. You know, it's interesting that at one point the majority says Congress enacted a copyright law that through the first sale doctrine limits copyright holders' ability to divide domestic markets and said that this is consistent with antitrust law, which ordinarily forbids market divisions. What Justice Breyer didn't say, however, is that he was talking about domestic markets, not global markets. And as far as U.S. antitrust law is concerned, the Robinson-Patman Act, which is that part of antitrust law that deals with the question of the prohibitions against price discrimination or price differentiation based upon market segmentation, does not apply to global trade. It only applies to trade within the United States. So basically, the majority in this case decided that it didn't see a policy that it readily recognized or liked in the language of the provisions that it was asked to interpret, so it came up with its own policy.
All right, can I just stop you? Jenny, did you have a response?
Well, I was going to respond to the kind of policy question you raised, which is why should the American people care that, you know, some publisher gets, you know, one cent instead of nine, or a fraction of a cent instead of nine? You know, you can take that approach to everything. It's what's that maxim, where you stand depends on where you sit. You know, if today I want to buy a Bic pen, I want it to be as cheap as possible. So it's great if that pen got imported from somewhere and I can pay nothing for it instead of what the, you know, Bic pen company would otherwise want to charge me. But if I happen to work for the big pen company, that's a bad thing. It's, you know, the U.S. publishing rate is something like a minimum wage for songwriters. How would it be if we said the U.S. minimum wage should be the lowest rate, applicable rate anywhere in the world? What would that be? You know, one baht an hour, you know, net to, you know, 2 cents. We have prices in the United States that are reflective of our economy for the good of the U.S. manufacturing and copyright and other industries here at prices the domestic market can support. In general terms, that's considered a good thing because we need to support our industries and not just our consumers.
Let me ask Lisa something that Alan mentioned. Did you think that Justice Breyer was going to be deciding this case? Because you said Alan said if anyone other than Breyer had written the decision, it would have been completely different. And that strikes me as an interesting observation. I didn't know whether you had a particular approach in litigation for that.
Yeah, I mean, we were targeting any specific justice because we didn't know what way the justices had come out in Costco because they split 4-4 with Kagan recusing, and there was no indication of who had gone which way. This particular issue is one of those issues where you can't just line them up based on their political parties and their historical beliefs because it tends to cross, and we were never really sure who was on which side. Now, in oral argument, we started to see some signs of who seemed to be in our favor, and Breyer was surely vocal at the argument and led us to believe that he was on our side. But we didn't direct, I don't think, our arguments at any particular justice. We were just hoping for Kagan.
Did you think that you were going to win?
That's a tough question.
Can I ask the others then, while you're thinking about that?
After the argument, we were cautiously optimistic.
Did you think you were going to win beforehand, given the earlier dicta and all of the other ways in which the...
We knew it was an uphill battle. I mean, it's a tough case, and the issues are tricky, and the way that folks were lining up on both sides in terms of the amici, there were a lot of issues and some tricky things that needed to be resolved, and we weren't sure.
Can I ask the representatives of the content industry, why did you guys lose?
Wow.
Yeah.
If they thought it was an uphill battle and everyone else was looking at it,
it's very difficult to say, but I think that there would probably be a fair number of people who thought that at the oral argument they were somewhat disappointed in the way in which the appellee's attorney handled some of the questions, particularly the questions about the so-called parade of horribles. Mr. Olson had his fastball that day.
Really? That's important?
Yeah.
I would say, just to respond to your position before about the congressional view and how the court didn't really take that into account, I would argue that wasn't squarely before the court in perhaps as persuasive a way as it sounds coming from you, for example. The court looked at what was in front of them and concluded that it wasn't clear that there was any intent to support a division of markets, and that was something that had happened and people argued for it, but there was never any indication in the legislative history from what the court was looking at that they wanted to do that, that they were intending to create a right to divide markets, that was something that was part of the Copyright Act. And so I think when perhaps there was more to say, I don't even think the government on their briefing in Kurtzsang did as much as they did in their prior briefing about the international regime and what the treaty negotiations were. And the court felt, I think, somewhat free to disregard a lot of that because it hadn't been repeated, and it was in the Quality King brief where the government took essentially our position on 109. So I think that there were some missing pieces that didn't get in front of the judges.
I also think that Wiley's counsel probably didn't anticipate the traction that what Alan's been referring to as the parade of horribles that Kurtzsang manufactured. You know, I've got my parade of horribles here, but they did a good job of convincing the court that you're never going to be able to sell your Lexus secondhand in the United States because it has an onboard computer with a piece of software in it. And the manufacturer of the software is going to prevent the sale of the car in the United States. And I guess every justice said, well, that's no good. And I like my Lexus, but tomorrow I want to own a BMW, so I got to get rid of that thing. But my
point was is that especially in light of the fact that those were hypotheticals, that there was no track record of it.
Right.
Ordinarily, in this kind of posture, the court should have said, "Well, we understand and we hear and are concerned about those, but your remedy is with Congress." If we read the statute the way Congress wrote it, and there isn't a constitutional question here that requires us to do otherwise. If we read the statute as Congress wrote it, it may be garbled, it may not make sense to the court, but as far as the complaints and criticisms and the fears of the consequences of reading it this way, all of those were messages to be taken back to Congress, not for the court to decide on its own that it was going to resolve that parade of horribles.
Well, what is the answer to the forever perpetual downstream control? Because there's no link to that in the statute with national exhaustion, because you're just stuck with it.
Well, first of all, I mean, for the court to decide that because of that, they are simply going to flip U.S. policy from one of national exhaustion to international exhaustion is just extraordinary, and there's no other way to view it. But beyond that, the point is that it's not perpetual control. What you're talking about here is a marketplace that is not in the United States. It's a marketplace abroad, which requires special conditions for U.S. manufacturers and distributors to be able to participate. The primary principle is they have to price to that market. And once they price to that market, and those goods are sold in that market, I don't think that any of the copyright owners have any intention or notion that they will continue to exercise any authority with respect to those goods. Other than that, they won't come back into the United States without their authorization to compete directly with their domestic products. That's the only control. Once they're sold out in those markets, I've never seen any indication that any copyright owner has made any plan or has indicated that they believe they have the authority to continue to control the further disposition of what happens to those goods in the foreign markets. The issue is coming back into the United States or going into another market to compete with them where they have
the
separate
goods come back in the U.S., so then what do we do?
Millions of what?
Millions of goods. I mean, lots and lots of
goods. Well, I mean, we have different ways of dealing with them. Many of those goods that would come back into the United States are stopped at the border by the Customs Service pursuant to allegations of trademark infringement. And basically, trademark owners can record their marks and the particular descriptions of their goods to see that that's the case. You have separate doctrines of exhaustion in patent law and copyright law, which have operated differently. But the principle has been basically the same. U.S. law has been viewed as not having extraterritorial effect unless Congress explicitly said it was intended to. And even there's an uphill climb in order to be able to make it stick. And as far as the first sale doctrine was concerned, when Bob's Merrill case basically created it as a judicially created doctrine, it was created entirely with the notion of domestic markets involved, not with markets abroad.
I might start here because we need some questions from the audience. Yes, up the back.
Well, I don't entirely agree with Jenny's willingness to equate Costco and books, because the irony of this case is that having interpreted the Copyright Act, the two great goods case, they finally got one with copyrighted material and decided the great goods case. But my question for Lisa is, why do you think that there, I mean, it seems to me Stevens was quite clear in Equality King that he was, that this was an act that was not intended for gray goods, for commercial goods. This was an act created for copyrighted works with licensed areas. And he cites the authority that's in the legislative history of complaints of American publishers about British works coming into the United States. It's right there in the legislative history and in that decision, which, by the way, was unanimous, including Breyer. And I don't understand, and by the way, he was also old enough to know that 601 was the manufacturing clause, and that when Congress cared about where something was manufactured, it knew how to say it. So the whole issue of where was something manufactured was a complete red herring in all of this, and always has been. I mean, American picture books have been manufactured in Europe and China for decades, and no one has suggested that that had anything to do with whether they were authorized for sale anywhere. So I don't understand why you think that this was so clearly intended to apply across the board for all goods. I mean, they finished the decision in Quality King by saying, you have a different problem, go to Congress. This statute was made for copyrighted works. Did no one address that?
You know, that didn't really come up very much. I mean, I think at some level we were appreciative that the case actually did involve textbooks as opposed to another, product that had been sort of fabricated to be a copyright.
Watch.
Yes, a watch with a logo.
Shampoo.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, we did have a discussion about at that level, but it never really went beyond that, sort of an internal discussion about the fact that, now we're finally dealing with an actual work that is intended to be, or was sort of the classic example of copyright coverage. But, I would say everyone had been operating under the assumption, you mentioned that books had been manufactured abroad for years, and I think everyone had been operating under the assumption that when you bring that book in and it gets sold, it's sold. And then you can do with it as you will. You can give it to a flea market. You can resell it at a used bookstore.
But after they were manufactured, they were then sold first by their licensed entities.
Right. Well, these books were sold first by the licensed entity, too. They just happened to be in Thailand.
Right.
So it has
So
been,
they were therefore not made under the statute?
Well, right. That's
right.
The debate. obviously, position is that it was made under the statute. But I think the interesting thing is, we talk about sort of the precedent and what has been happening and what the public was used to doing. I think it's a little bit of an exaggeration to say the law was clear. I don't think the law was clear. And I think that if you look at a majority of the amici that put briefs in on behalf of Kurtzang, they have been operating under the assumption that they can take their foreign-made thing and do with it as they will, because they're the owner of it. And that's how they've been operating for 30 years. So it's a little bit, it's a tricky comparison.
What is left of 602? Because you talked about licenses and pirated goods, but you don't really need 602 to protect yourself in those situations, right? If there's an importation in the United States, you'll have a contractual remedy. If there's pirated product, you have a duplication remedy, which is an impact on your sale doctrine. So, in effect, I know, Susan said there was something left of 602, but in reality, is there?
Movie theater owners.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that is that the anecdote about movie theater owners actually presages the whole notion of licensed intangible goods, basically, in terms of the actual relationship between the parties. One of the things that's so interesting about this case is that, among the other things that you can find in the majority's opinion, is a clear-cut view that, for example, there is no such thing as a digital first sale doctrine. That comes out very clearly from Justice Breyer's recounting what he called the impeccable historic pedigree of the first sale doctrine. And it's also true that when they were explaining the situation with movie theater owners, that's exactly parallel to the issue of what happens when somebody who is a copyright owner essentially deals in their goods not with actual purchases or sales that transfer ownership, but in fact is licensing terms and conditions for use and possession. So, all of this, unfortunately, is one of the reasons why this is teed up not just a narrow issue of fixing the five words that Justice Breyer so torturously linguistically analyzed, but this sets up the possibility that if Congress is to look at this issue at all, there is a growing food fight that will take place, because one set of issues links completely to another set of issues, and that ultimately is the question around whether there should be a digital first sale doctrine, and whether or not
as a particular lobbying group has it, when you buy something, you own it. They seem to think that that's true for everything in society, but they seem to have avoided the digital end of society in putting forward that belief.
We have another question.
Hi, thanks. So I guess I think we're so far afield from what this statute ever could have meant, and that the statute does so little now that we couldn't possibly have forgotten the right place. And I think the reason is because Lonzo was wrong with the sign. Even though everybody lived with Lonzo for many years and kind of thought, well, there must be something to that distinction and we need to kind of work around it. So I'm wondering if the people on the panel would agree with that Lonzo was wrongly decided. And I think if you read the Kagan concurrence, it's the only thing that makes sense in this whole opinion. Everybody else is just right. We hear themselves talk and justify. Somebody said it, a very academic position that has nothing to do with the sale of books or the sale of anything or just, whatever Congress was trying to do. And I also think the Kagan concurrence answers the question at this point, to some extent, was raising back there. It's really not a first sale question. It's about importation, right? To try to track down the provenance of a first sale is just silly. Nobody thinks you can really do that, right? But you can focus on the folks who are importing these copyrighted works under the statute, and I think reach a rational result, regardless of where the books were published. I guess that's what it comes down to. So I'm wondering if anybody has thoughts on whether Lonzo himself was right, particularly, late at night, in the middle of the night. Did you ever say to yourself, this can't be right? This can't be right.
I
think that all the time, but it has nothing to do with this case.
So did anyone want to pick up on that?
Well, look, from where, the content and manufacturing, big businesses in the United States, let me put it this way, Lanza is unfortunate. the world would be better for us if that had gone the other way. It's just very hard to square with the first sale doctrine, which uses the word made, not sold. So when you say that there is an exhaustion of rights when the product is made pursuant to the U.S. Copyright Act and it was domestically produced, even if with the intent of shipping it abroad for its first sale abroad, it's very hard to square that factual scenario with the text of the statute, though I think as a policy matter, you're absolutely right. What would have been a better outcome is to say, what was the intent of the manufacturer, the copyright owner, in creating this good? Was this good intended for domestic sale or foreign sale? And if the latter, then the first sale doctrine doesn't apply, but it's very hard to get there from here.
Yeah, I would also say that it's unfortunate that this case did become all about the gray market, based on the way in which Mr. Kurtzang and his supporters argued the case, even though that wasn't the pedigree of the case in the previous occasions when the issues about the first sale doctrine's relationship to the ban on unauthorized importation had come before the court. As a practical matter, it's also unfortunate that consumers, I think to some extent, are being sold a bill of goods about what they have gotten out of the Kurtzang decision, because it's only a short-term benefit. The reality is that the gray market exists at all because it is reasonably bounded to be tolerated by manufacturers and distributors who otherwise are able to continue their business. What the Supreme Court's decision here does, however, it ultimately says to, say, a publisher like John Wiley, says, if you're going to continue to want to have an export market, you won't be able to continue to price to that market if that means pricing lower than the market in the United States, because those books will all be coming back into the United States and you can't stop it. It's going to be legal. So that gives that exporter a limited series of choices. They could either try to price the same as they would in the United States, which means they're going to have very few foreign markets, since the per capita income of most people in most countries and the degree to which, for example, in the case of this particular copyrighted good, the government support or subsidized students in their college education is much less than it is in the United States. It's fairly doubtful that there will be those foreign markets in existence for this type of exporter. And if that's the case, over time, what it means is that the U.S. consumer is no longer going to benefit with respect to that particular product
from the existence of a gray market. So they haven't achieved what the consumers so vigorously sought to defend and hold on to here. In the long term, that market is going to disappear because it makes no business sense for a copyright-based producer of these kinds of works to continue to export them if this remains the law in a situation where arbitrage is the natural consequence of that export policy.
Okay, well, I'd love to take 100 more questions. I'd also like to ask the panelists directly about Bob Goodlatte's announcement that he's doing a review in the wake of this, or perhaps not in the wake of this, but we don't have time because the organizers have said we have to get out of here at 2 o'clock. So I hope you'll join with me in thanking the panelists.